Willkommen zu einer neuen Folge von Metal Minds, der Pit Unplugged, dem Metal.de Podcast. Mein Name ist Diana Heinbucher und ich bin eure Gastgeberin. Und Boston Manor habe ich heute zu Gast. Genau. Henry und Mike habe ich auf dem Impericon Festival getroffen, dieses Jahr in Leipzig. Und wir haben uns Zeit genommen und ein bisschen, ja, gequatscht. Boston Manor ist ja eine britische Band und ich glaube, die haben sich schon längst einen festen Platz in der Alternative- und Metalcore-Szene erspielt. Mit ihrem Sound bewegen sie sich zwischen Energie und Melancholie und mit ihren Gedanken zeigen sie, warum Authentizität in der Musik wichtiger ist als Perfektion. Euch erwartet ein sehr tiefgründiges Gespräch. Wir sprechen über digitale Technologien, die Gitarrenmusik verändern. Wir sprechen über Unvollkommenheit und warum gerade Unvollkommenheit eine Stärke ist und wieso kleine Clubs und lokale Szenen die eigentliche Zukunft der Musik bilden. Ein Gespräch über Kreativität, Haltung und die Frage, was Musik lebendig macht. Ich wünsche euch ganz viel Spaß mit Henry und Mike von Boston Manor. Das Interview ist natürlich auf Englisch und ja, verzeiht mir, mein Englisch ist nicht ganz fehlerfrei, aber ich glaube, der Kern kommt gut rüber.
Thank you to be here. Please introduce yourself.
I'm Henry and I'm the singer.
I'm Mike and I play guitar in Boston Manor.
And how are you today?
We're very good. We're very warm, but we're very good.
Where played you yesterday?
Yesterday we drove for 15 hours. It was a very fun day. But the day before we played in Brighton as a warm-up show. And the day before that we played with A Day to Remember in London. Today's our first day of a two-week run in Europe doing festivals. And yeah, we're in Leipzig at Impericon Festival, and it's a good time.
Okay, and the podcast named Metal Minds, the Pit Unplugged. When was your last time in a pit?
Oh,
yeah,
in a pit.
Yeah, do you join the pit?
Not in my advanced years, but I do remember the last time I did try and crowd surf, and I can't remember the show we were at. But I got dropped twice and hurt my back. And that was the last of my crowd surfing days. Yeah.
I think I might have done this since then. I was in the pit in one of our US shows for one of the support bands. But the last time me and Mike were both in a pit was at Rock 'Em Ring in, I think, 2021 for 2022 for Deftones.
Yeah.
And we went right at the front and it was just us. And a bunch of shirtless Germans jumping around, and we had a great time.
Yeah, but now you're with your band are in a pit, we could say. And how do you currently perceive the shifts in that happening in the music industry?
It's a big question.
Yeah. So that you can freely told me everything you thought about it.
The shifts in the trends of the music industry. What do you think, Mike?
It's hard, honestly, quite hard for me to say anything about it without, I guess, complaining in a way. But I speak for everyone, but we think guitar music is kind of being neutered at the moment with a lot of digital equipment, whether it's live or in the studio. And I feel like it just sucks all of the kind of sincerity and the energy out of live guitar music. And I'm not speaking for everyone. I think there are so many bands right now that don't do that. But I think I know it sounds a little bit depressing, but I find like rock music to be a little bit soulless at the moment. And I want to hear people getting back to the roots of real guitar music with amps and real feeling and a little bit more rough around the edges, you know.
Yeah.
I think that, to Mike's point, this problem, it extends beyond just the music and the equipment. I think it stems from the way that bands form or artists kind of begin and the platform through which they have at their disposal to release their art. They don't write music. People don't write music to play live. They write music to go on the internet. So everything is made in a computer. It's written in a computer. It's made in a computer. It's released on a computer. Often with no intention of ever playing it live, and it becomes so fantastical and unrealistic that and it has to sound perfect because everybody expects everything to sound completely perfect and pristine anymore. No one knows what like just a microphone pointed at an amp and a microphone and a singer singing and it sounds like anymore. Everything sounds so auto-tuned and pristine and perfect and clipped that people are afraid to have it any less than perfect. So they form these internet bands, and then they have to go and spend €30,000 on a rig to auto-tune them live and do all this kind of stuff. And listen, I'm not trying to judge any band in particular. I know lots of amazing bands that use this technology to their benefit, but I think when that becomes the baseline, the standard, you know, and it becomes, in fact, I wasn't going to use an example, but I will. We watched a set from Turnstile playing Jimmy Kimmel, and that band's incredible. Like, I absolutely love that band. We all love them. They're amazing, and they're all amazing players. Brendan, the singer, is an incredible singer. And I read the comments, and there's a few people saying, like, oh, his voice sounds like out of tune. It absolutely doesn't, for the record, but he's singing and jumping around and singing in a microphone really intense music, and he sounds amazing. He sounds incredible. But because these kids have discovered, a lot of them have only discovered like heavy music after the pandemic, they're quite young, and everything they've heard, it goes through autotune live, so they don't know what like actual live singing sounds like. And Brendan's a better singer than me, like he's amazing. But when the expectation is that everything sounds as good as the record live, we're doing musicians a disservice, and we're spending too much time now as artists, or other people are spending too much time now as artists, making things perfect rather than making the music great, you know?
Yeah.
I think a lot of these artists may be disillusioned and maybe trying to get a little shortcut to where they want to be. And I think a lot of people forget that it should be expression, and it should be emotional and an extension of who you are as a person. And I think a lot of people are kind of forgetting about that, and I think a lot of people are forgetting to enjoy themselves with it as well.
100%.
Yeah. So I kind of liken a lot of the music that comes out today to Marvel films, which I particularly don't enjoy, with all of the special effects and stuff like that. I just it doesn't do anything for me personally. But
embrace imperfection, you know. Yeah. Like, some of the best songs that were ever written were not made with very impressive technology. It was all made just with a couple of microphones and a really good idea, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. What you said, I think about an interview I did last year with Normandie. It's a Swedish band, and they also told me in the next 5 to 10 years there will be two kinds of musicians. The one musicians, they do music only for publishing through internet, and the other musicians are live musicians. And the live musicians had to take the hurdle to be perfect in every way. And it's so hard to understand, because live music, if you said it's emotionally, and there it's okay to have a wrong tone and
it's, mistakes.
Yeah, yeah. It's totally.
It means it's real. It means it was played live in the moment. You know, it's unique to that experience. And I think actually, there's going to be a push back on this and a movement away from this, because not by everybody, but if you look at how popular the aesthetic of film photography has become on Instagram, how much people are wearing vintage clothing, how much people are putting vintage furniture in their houses and using real wood textures in their furnishings. People want to hark back to a time of analog and craftsmanship and human authentication. They want to move away from like digital perfection. And there's always going to be a majority that want everything to sound pristine and perfect and great, and they can click their fucking fingers in their cars as they drive to work. But there's always going to be a big desire, I think, for something that was made with deep passion and has a real humanity about it.
I think a lot of this is going to come from the young generation as well. I read a really interesting article about how Generation Z, Gen Z, were are basically nostalgic for a time that they never even got to experience. And they are surrounding themselves. And like Henry said, they are dressing in vintage clothes and they're listening to older bands and older artists now. And we brought out a few younger bands with us in the United States, and they all had guitar amps, and they're all fascinated with grunge and shoegaze music, guitar pedals and stuff like that. And a lot of them, I've seen people even breaking out like a Discman to listen to CDs again. And
really?
they're thirsty for this nostalgia of a time that they never had. I think they're just so fascinated with it because all they know is a digital age. That's all they've seen.
Well, can you imagine how different it must seem? I was thinking this the other day, yesterday actually. Mike at the moment is using like Apple wired earphones because his AirPods are broken. And I was looking at him and I was like, man, to like anybody born after the year 2005 or something, maybe a little later, I don't know, but like that's going to seem like such vintage technology, you know, like what wired anything is going to seem so old school, which is so, to us, it's like so weird, you know. Yeah. But I think Mike's right. I think people, because with all this stuff, there's a craftsmanship, there's an element of imperfection, and I think that the imperfection stems from it being human. And I think as the more we move to everything being made in a computer, whether it's imagery, whether it's you know, you're outsourcing your thinking to ChatGPT, whether you're you know, generating all of your album covers on Firefly or Midjourney or whatever it is, I think people are maybe not too worried about it, but I think that people will be surprised by how many people actually reject a lot of that in the long term.
Yeah, to keep on Turnstile, because they, I don't know if they said it, but I read it somewhere. They have a very low-level light show. There's nothing. They have their amps and their speakers, and then there's nothing. And the other ones I see, they have impressive light shows, mm-hmm. and so on. And this is also something that I think we don't need all the light on the stage.
Yeah.
We agree. For selfish reasons and me personally, I grew up going to shows like a long time ago. And when I saw a band, there was none of any of those gimmicks or like bells and whistles. And I just saw like a good rock band with like decent lighting, and that for me was exciting enough. And I think it should be more about the band and less about the technology behind it and all of the bells and whistles that go into it. I mean, I guess like some people make a full career out of that. I feel like Baby Metal, I feel like people go for that kind of show, you know. But for us,
Bring Me the Horizon to some extent, like the production is a big part of the show. Like it has its place for sure. But I think we were lucky enough to see the Turnstile hometown show, the first big show they did on this cycle in Baltimore. And it was just in a park. It was just a stage in the middle of the day in the park. And it was like the best show I've ever seen in my life. It was so insane, you know. And that's the thing is like, when the music's that good, you don't need all the bells and whistles. We do. We need a good light show because we're not Turnstile. But that being said, I think there's an authenticity to Turnstile that comes from a subculture they're deeply rooted in, and punk. They're a punk band by and large. Like, don't get it twisted. They're a punk band, and there's a DIY ethos to that band. They have a very rich heritage of bands they've all been in. They're a big fixture in their community, which Baltimore has a huge punk heritage and hardcore heritage. And when you have 10,000 people that all want to jump off a stage, what are some strobes doing? Like, yeah. You don't need that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I never see Turnstile or saw Turnstile live before, but I see the videos, the live videos, and every time I think that's emotion, that's true emotion, and let the people are there for the emotion, the connection through the music. And so
people will look back on Turnstile as a significant band of this generation, I think. I think they've earned their place in history for good reason.
And the other thing you said, people start to listening to music from older generations, and it's very funny. My son, he's 10 and he's discovering the music from the 70s and 80s at the moment.
Cool. What does he like?
No. It's more like Queen and it's very cool to listen with him to music. And then I start to think about how they made music and how now the musicians make music.
Yeah.
And how you have from then to then such a clear sound, there are no effects like this. Yeah. And then, but it touches you. And sometimes now when new music is released, there's an overload on effects. And
yeah, we listened to a couple of records yesterday that had that going on. Yeah, I think there's no substitute for good songwriting, you know?
No.
Like, I think I feel a certain way about Rick Rubin, but I think he's right on the money when he says if you can play it, if you can strip it back to just the singer and an acoustic guitar and it still sounds like a great song, it's probably a great song. Yeah. Good statement, I think. And yeah, yeah, you know, you look at like Oasis, the most simple compositions ever, but the songs are so, they pass through the generation, especially where we come from. It's you know, it's like the national anthem or something. It's everybody knows it, and it's because they're so well written and they're so simple, but they're all, you know, it's a vocal and a couple of instruments and that's it, you know.
The other thing is I think today many bands are under pressure between to have as much as possible creative freedom, and then on the other side they need to think strategically. So we all know that the strategic thinking may cut down the creativity thing. So how you handle it? How would you describe your creative freedom? And on the other side, how much do you need to think strategically?
To be honest, we've always found that we've always got the best results when we've just done exactly what we wanted to do. And I say this in every interview, but I feel like you need to write music like you're a fan of your own band. And when we were writing, especially on the last record as well, I found that it all became so much easier and more simple in my head when I kind of just like closed my eyes to what was going on around us and just kind of let go of all of that. And kind of just like, to be honest, when I write music, I try and impress these guys. I try and get these guys stoked. You know, I think because when you're up there on the stage and you're playing those songs every single night, if you don't believe in what you're playing, it really does become a chore and it becomes a job. And I think it's the best way to stay fresh. And if you try and follow trends and if you try and do what everybody else is doing, you're always going to be left behind in the dust, because by the time you release their music, everyone's hopped on the next trend. And I don't know if you want to expand.
No, they've said it, yeah, better than I could. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, and sometimes in this role to go with the trend, for example, labels and managements speak to musicians to get them on their way. And what do you think? What role does labels play today compared to times earlier, and maybe also to you as a band?
I think in terms of the label thing, I see this a lot in like YouTube comments. Whenever a band releases an album that some of their fans don't like, and they're like, "Oh, the labels made them make this record," and I mean, I can only speak to our experience, but the labels, but we've been on two labels now, and they've never had any input on the music that we make at all. And same with management, they've never tried to do anything that they've only ever sort of try to nurture what we do and be the business side of it, you know. I think that's quite an outdated idea. I mean, I know that I've heard, we've worked with producers who are older than, you know, from done stuff in previous decades who've said, yeah, you know, when we work with this band from this major label, they have an A&R guy breathing down your neck. But I don't think that's as much of a thing anymore. I can't speak to what it's like to be on a major label. Maybe that's different. I think navigating the business side is harder than it's ever been. So I think they have their hands full doing that, to be quite honest. But maybe we've just been lucky. But we've only ever had like a very supportive label and management team that have kind of let us just get on with it, you know, here be beauty, there be pie charts kind of thing.
Yeah. Okay, so you're lucky once.
Maybe so.
Yeah. Boys That's Fire told me some years before they have such a thing with as they were on their first major deal. The label came and say, try this and that. And we go to the studio and you need to do it in this way and there and so. And it was quite strange.
That sounds awful.
Yeah. Yeah. They mean they learn something about it. But it's hard to put your creative way around 180 degrees around. So it's awful.
I think we're not even just speaking about music, but whether it's movies or comic books or whatever it is, TV shows. I think the best art comes from when the least amount of people have interfered, you know? Like, if you look at the great auteurs of film, it's usually like when a person wrote and directed it and they had a really great producer that kept the studio away from them and let them make the movie that they wanted to make. And, you know, like, best scenario in my mind as a artist is the band come together with this record and they have a great producer who believes in it. And nobody else gets involved, you know? It's just you and the producer and you make the record together. And
on a point in the music production process, you start to open what you do to people outside. The most bands do this. They are not anymore only the band and the producer. Maybe they share the music to friends to get feedback or to other people. How is it with you?
We're pretty... we're quite secretive about what we make. I think I don't think the record really goes beyond us and our producer and anyone that's working directly on the record until press get involved and then the record gets kind of sent out to them. But I think that kind of, to be honest, is a little bit dangerous and may just kind of like make you second guess yourself and maybe stop you in your tracks creatively as well. I think the more people that you have involved, the more diluted your art becomes. It can be, I mean, like Henry said before as well, everyone works differently and different strokes for different folks. But the way that we've always worked is we've always been quite insular with our creative process.
Because I think like your example, sending it to friends, you'll either get one of two things is you'll get reinforcement that maybe isn't necessarily healthy. You know, your mate going, oh, that's the best thing I've ever heard. That's so good. You're a genius. Mm-hmm. Which you're definitely not, no one is, and you'll believe it. Or you get the other side where somebody who maybe doesn't know the full context of the big picture of the record that you're making and will hear some music and they'll be like, I don't like that. And then you start to think, oh, I suck and everything I make is bad and I should rethink this whole song with no context of everything. So yeah, I think trusting your bandmates, trusting your producer, and you know, you can't go far wrong. And the worst case is you make a record that you love and everyone else hates, but it's a lot worse to make a record that you hate and everyone else loves.
Yeah.
It feels worse than that. Making a record that you hate and everyone else also hates.
But I don't know. I think there's not really a band outside. They published a record and said after this was a shit that we published.
People, I hear bands all the time, like, shit talking some of their albums in public. And I think that's such a slap in the face to the people that bought that record, because there'll always be people that love an album and have formed an emotional attachment to an album. Yeah. And they'll be like, oh, that's shit. Mm. And it's like, no, that's the record you made it in a time and place. And if you don't like it, then keep that to yourself. You know, somebody else will care deeply about that record, you know?
Okay, thank you.
Egos,
so much.
Egos.
Sometimes we speak about AI,
yes.
But sometimes we speak in a very unprecise way about AI.
Right.
We have on the one side, we have algorithm, and then we have tools, they do something for us. They interpret what we want to do. But for example, the digital workflows, they are not an algorithm. They are an algorithm because they label the music in a way.
Sure.
But don't make new music in another way. Do you understand? It's very hard for me to explain it at the moment.
You're explaining a very complex idea in your second language, so don't worry at all. Yeah, I mean, to answer it broadly, I think I roughly understand the question, but I think AI has its place speeding up people's workflow, but I'm seeing it creep. I'm a graphic designer as well, and I'm seeing it massively intrude on that space and creep into people's creative workflows in ways that are very lazy and unwarranted. And I also think there's a bigger thing to say about, I can get any answer at my fingertips as quick as I want, whatever it is, you know, problem troubleshooting. Like I use like some quite complicated technology for programming, like visual effects, and also like integrating visual effects with live performances and stuff. I'm not a coder. I don't understand coding. So I have used ChatGPT or something similar to speed that process up. But when you start outsourcing your thinking, so, oh, it'll be quicker to just make the robot make my brain go faster than my brain, I think we're setting a dangerous precedent for how we evolve and continue to grow as people. I also think that if you're letting AI make any creative decisions for you, you are stepping down a dark path. Like if you're letting AI write your lyrics, if you're letting AI decide how your guitar sounds, if you're letting AI help you streamline song structures, you are cyborging your art. Like you've got to, the computer should be the very blunt instrument, not the part, well, sorry, wrong choice of words. The computer should be the base level, like foundations of the house, not the curtains on the windows or the, you know, the carpets. Like keep AI away from the beauty of the thing that you're making. That's my opinion, but this is an evolving subject with things that change every day, and it's very complicated.
I think there's a little bit of I guess like self-discipline as well, and a little bit of like trusting in yourself and your own intuition, because I do use a current digital technology for when we demo. I use it for amps, so I don't have a really loud amp. I don't have a microphone in my bedroom on an amplifier blasting really loud. So there are definitely a lot of like technological advances that I do like as helpful tools for being creative. But I think it's down to the user how much of that you carry forward into your art and what you leave behind and what you kind of like, what you do use. And I'm really, I'm extremely particular about how that affects the way things sound. Like I still use guitar pedals with the digital amps because I don't like things to sound too perfect and too clean, and it kind of like creeps me out a little bit. I like things to sound a little bit as normal as possible, basically.
You addressed two important things I want to follow up. The one thing is our brain is a muscle, and if we stop using it, if we outsource the decisions, we stop to train this muscle, and we start to be uncritical.
Atrophy,
yeah.
Muscle atrophy of the brain.
Exactly. And the other thing you said is use it as a tool, and this is it. Use it as a tool is something other than to let them do something for you, to co-work with this. Maybe is okay because you need to think about.
We had we actually had a discussion because we like kind of debating topics like AI because it is a very new concept to us. But I do think back to when the internet became super mainstream, yeah. and I saw that scientists were kind of measuring how your brain changes based on the discovery of the internet and the how the internet was kind of like spread and how everyone was using it. And scientists did find that our brains did change rather than storing information like we were used to, or, you know, having to actually remember things. Our brain changed to, okay, where can I find this information? You know, what do I need to do to find this? And I think the same thing is going to happen again with AI, where our brains and human beings need to be able to adapt, because it's going to be everywhere now. You know, there's going to be no stopping it. But another thing with AI is you get out of it what you put into it as well. So you have to know which questions to ask or what to put into it, or you're going to get. It's garbage in, garbage out, basically.
But
also, I do think that there will be some laziness, some atrophy, but it's always down to the user and it's down to their decision. If they want to throw everything into AI, that's on them. But if you want to stay true, or if you want to figure things out yourself, you know, it's all down to your own discipline, I guess.
My brain actually makes some connections, what you said. So I'm doing research. I'm a PhD student. I'm doing research on creativity and team creativity, and also on how creativity evolves during adolescence. And mostly they measure creativity with old tests. And so they are thinking about that they need to adapt the tests for creativity and also for intelligence to adapt them, because the tests are from the 1970s and 1980s. And now you said it, with the upcoming internet, we don't need to store so much information, but we need to know where we get the information from. And so the skills we need, the skills they are in our brain, other than before. So,
I think it's interesting to look at parallels between the invention of the modern internet and before. But it really is a hop, skip and a jump, because I get wary, and this is not about, nothing to do with what Mike was saying, because I think that's super relevant. But I think when people start being complacent about AI and saying, oh, everybody said this about radio when the television was invented, and everybody said this about the internet, and you know, and no one's going to watch TV anymore. I think that comparison is irrelevant when it comes to AI, because I think AI is, there's a before AI and an after AI, and the difference is stark. I think that we have no frame of reference for what this is going to do to economies, to history, to culture, but particularly to the grand sociology of people's lives. I think that we are asking ourselves, can we do this? Not should we do this as a species? And we're in an arms race with China. Well, we are not in an arms race with China. Sam Altman is in an arms race with China, and they are pushing as fast as they can to get the most advanced product that they can. And they are not asking, what is this going to do to complete industries, to economies, and to the environment as well? And I think that this is we're in, you know, the 1940s again with the nuclear bomb. It's we are pushing ahead at light speed to try and win a race, and we are not stopping to think of the calamity that is going to be caused. And that's not to say that I don't use AI in my daily life, because I do, unfortunately. I think that on the other side of the coin, sort of saying, oh, I'm going to boycott it, is, you know, you can't unbake a cake, you know, it's here to stay. But I think there are huge questions to be asked about what the huge knock-on effects that are going to happen, not 2 years down the line, but 120 years down the line.
Yeah. Okay. To come to an end, is there something you wish the industry would start valuing more again?
Quite a lot.
Quite a lot, yeah.
Art, maybe. you know, paying artists for their music and not funding weapons ballistic systems in the Middle East instead of giving musicians music. That would be a good start. I wish that small one, venue merch cuts, fuck off. We don't need venue merch cuts. Get rid of them all around the world. It's a complete scam. yeah, venues have it hard, but don't take that money off the artists. We print the merch, we design the merch, we sell the merch. You don't deserve any of the money from those merch cuts. I wish that we would, I mean, maybe being idealistic, I think countries like France and Canada have a really great system where they can afford to publicly subsidize some of their exports. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, you have amazing venues, you have artists who can feed their families from touring and things, because we don't talk enough about the value of music in terms of a country's output, you know, soft power, all that kind of thing. And yeah, I wish that we would, on a small, super small scale, micro scale, if you're a rock band, a guitar band, I wish that we would start getting together in small rooms and starting bands and playing to 50 people again, and not making our first single the goal for it to go viral and it only to live on the internet. I wish that we could go back to a space where music was shared in small rooms by communities and you could build a platform from that. Because if you're an artist listening to this and you're starting out, I think that would serve you better. I think you will make more connections. I think more people will want to support you. And I think you'll become a better player and a better artist because you will see the actual reaction to that without all the bells and whistles on it. I feel quite strongly about that. I think that our scenes are dying. Part of that is because some of our venues are going, at least in the UK they are. But I think let's stop trying to make everything big on TikTok first, yeah. You know?
In a fast-changing world, Boston Manor stays true to their curse, craving a space for synergy and sonic growth. Thanks for letting us peek behind your curtain. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Das war der Metal Minds The Pit Unplugged Podcast von metal.de. Mein Name war, ist und wird es immer sein, Diana Heinbucher. Ich war eure Gastgeberin und ich wünsche euch noch eine fantastische Zeit. Nächste Woche geht's weiter. Bis dahin, bleibt Metal.